You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey everyone, Carlton here. For episode 167 of Life in Ruins podcast, we are going to be running an encore episode. But just this week, we'll be right back next week. Connor's in the field. I just got back from the DR. David is in the depths of doing ethnocynology things. So we'll be back with content next week. But for now, we'd like to rerun episode 31, The Archaeology of Childhood with Mackenzie Corey. Mac is now officially Dr. Corey. Him and his partner, Emily Van Alst, who's also been on the podcast a number of times, they both defended last month. They got their edits in. So we will have both of them on soon to talk about the results of their dissertations, Mac on the Archaeology of Childhood and Emily on Lakota rock art from a Lakota perspective. But for now, please go ahead, enjoy this rerun of episode 31, and we'll be back with next week with our regular scheduled content. Welcome to episode 31 of A Life in Ruins podcast, where we investigate the careers of those living a life in ruins. I'm your host, Carlton Gover, and tonight I am joined just by my co-host, Connor Johnen. David Ian Howe is, I think, shooting a commercial for Maybelline right now, and he was unable to join us. So tonight, we had a very special guest, a close friend of mine. We were interviewing PhD candidate Mackenzie Corey, who's in the anthropology department at the University of Indiana Bloomington, the third one we've had from that department. Third time's a charm. So, Mr. Corey, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Well, I think we're doing great. Connor, how about yourself?
Oh, you know. No, I'm doing fine on this. What is it? The second day of September. It's doing fantastic. So, Mac, I know you through proximity, through like Damien and Cassidy and all these like University of Wyoming folks. In general, how did you kind of get into science and archaeology when you're growing up?
You've probably heard this a dozen times before, but I was really into paleontology as a kid. When I was seven, I could name off half of the dinosaurs out there. Don't remember any of it now. As a kid, I liked playing in the dirt. I had Tonka trucks and would just dig into the side of the hill out behind the house. But then in high school, I kind of went through several different phases, like maybe I want to be an aerospace engineer. Oh, well, maybe I want to be a doctor. And then I realized that I really want a chance to work outside. So I thought about kind of what can I do where it's scientific. I get to work outside. I get to kind of capitalize on what I'm good at. And at the time, I was getting really into history. So I just thought, let's combine it all, look at archaeology. And I turned out to love it.
And you're a Wyoming boy, aren't you?
No, I went to University of Wyoming, but I've lived all across the U.S. My dad's in the steel industry. I've spent most of my childhood in Pennsylvania, went to high school in Kansas, and then moved out to Wyoming for undergrad. But at the end of the day, Wyoming's where I feel most at home.
Understood, man. Yeah, I've always associated with you with Wyoming, and I can't remember why, because I know we've had this conversation about your upbringing several times over the dinner table or the bar. And as you mentioned, we have heard it several times, hashtag dinosaurs are a gateway drug to science.
Yes.
Thank you, Talia from DMNS for that amazing soon-to-be t-shirt and stamp that we got coming on.
Also, this podcast is sponsored by Tonka Trucks. Very early on, Tonka Trucks made us the way we are. So going on from that, Carlton.
Absolutely. Why did you choose Wyoming for your undergraduate degree?
So I toured three schools in high school. I toured KU coming from Kansas. It was a natural choice. I met with Jack Hoffman when I was there. And it was close to home. It was cool. Started filling out my application for that. And then my dad and I took a road trip and went and saw Wyoming and CU Boulder. So at Wyoming, I just kind of fell in love with the campus. We got there, and the campus just felt like the perfect size for me. I met with some of the honors program people there, and I liked the whole feel of it. I liked the buildings. They met with the admissions people, and they offered me a decent scholarship that definitely contributed. And then I met with a few professors in the department. I think I met with maybe Bob Kelly and Todd Surivel, and chatted with them a little bit, and it felt right. Then Next day, went down to CU Boulder, actually met with Doug Bamforth, your advisor. I'm sure he doesn't remember it, but it just felt too big for me. Like, I was coming from a town of about 10,000 in Kansas, and Boulder just felt huge.
Yeah.
Boulder sucks.
God, you and what was that other girl's name? Carson. Both of you guys could just shove it. I love Boulder. And Bob Kelly wanted to come here when he was an undergrad or his master's.
Fort Collins whatever. Is way better. Get out of here, even though you're way better Carlton, funded.
Oh, geez.
You know what I like? I like paying $350 a month in rent.
Hey-o.
Oh, dude, I know. If I could move the Wyoming housing market down to here, I'd be set. But, you know, we really, you know, to Connor, we need to reach out to Bob and Todd because we need royalties for Fifth Beginning and like people going to Wyoming at this point. I think anytime they have a new student, they said, oh, I listen to Life in Ruins. We need a chunk of that tuition money, free advertisement.
Were you familiar with like Todd and Bob when you first like came to Wyoming?
So I had seen Nicole Waggisback on like PBS documentaries and Melissa Murphy. When I met with Bob, he seemed pretty cool, but it's embarrassing to say I had no idea who he was.
Same, bro. I went there to be his student and I had no idea who that man was.
But yeah, it was a really good fit for me. And I actually stopped. I never bothered starting an application to Boulder. And I stopped filling out my application to KU. I only applied to Wyoming for undergrad.
That's awesome, man. And so when you got there, how did you get involved with Hell Gap? Because that's a huge part of kind of Wyoming archaeology at this point. You know, Mary Lou and Arcel have been there for so long and have really put this site on the map. So how did you kind of get into that?
It was dumb luck. I was a bit of a moron 2 weeks into classwork. I was like, yeah, this is pretty easy. I have lots of free time. I should try and volunteer for something. So I went to Todd and I asked Todd about it. And he didn't have anything for a new undergrad at the moment. But he's like, go talk to Marcel. Marcel's always looking for people. So I talked to Marcel and he's like, okay, come in next week. We can start having you pick Matrix. And I picked Matrix for a year.
Oh, no. How much calcium carbonate did you have to sort through?
So much. Just meters of calcium carbonate in gallon-sized baggies. But yeah, after that, he liked my volunteer work, so he offered me an hourly job working in his lab, and it just kind of snowballed from there. Following summer, I was working out in the field with him at Last Canyon and Hell Gap, and haven't really stopped. I think this is the first summer since I started that I actually didn't get out to Hell Gap.
Yeah, dude. I think that's, in terms of field stories, not being able to go, that's pretty universal for a lot of us through COVID, which unfortunately is still going on. You got to be, as an undergraduate, right, a crew chief at Hell Gap, which is now a National Historic Landmark?
Right after undergraduate. So it was the year I graduated that summer.
Okay. That's very impressive. I also did that, and I know the rigors of working for Marcel and Mary on the field.
Yeah.
And running a site. And, I think one of the most valuable things I learned about Hell Gap was not just like how to manage students, but how to support, feed, and upkeep a site.
Yeah.
Well, because especially that one, because it's a ton of upkeep you have to do. It's not like some site you go dig one summer, you know, and you're done or whatever. They have like is it a building around that block?
Several.
That's super important.
Yeah. So I learned pretty much so I started working there when I was under 21. So when people would go into town to go to the bar, I would hang out in the park, check my email and call people. And then I had to start learning how to do things like small engine repair, roofing, using some of my free time to keep the site functioning.
Electrical, like carpentry.
Yeah.
Extra stuff. It's like, oh, the generator's broken again. You know, it's just like, oh, you know, Carl, yep, go fix the generator. I'm like, dude, I don't know anything about engines or electrical or fuel maintenance. Like, I don't know these things. Yeah, Hellgap is a fun site, and yeah, I definitely miss it a bit. It has a special place in my heart. And then also, you have to do tours at Hellgap. There's visitations.
Yes, there are, and there is a terrible YouTube video of me on the internet giving a tour.
One of my favorite lines, and I totally stole this from a guy named Justin, who's a graduate student at KU. He was also there. He'd always finish the tour. He's like, you know, we'll never know what Paleo Indians used to call this site or where they used to call home, but we do know when they came across the horizon and saw this area, they said, "Wow, that's one hell of a gap." And it was the dorkiest dad joke, but it was just, everybody thought it was funny. And I've just kind of never forgotten that little piece of working there. You know, that's what it, Hellgap always does. 10x4s, 10 days in the field, 4 days off. And you know, yep. by day seven, tensions are rising.
Oh no, yeah.
No way. There is no tension in field work. Ever. Kind of segueing off of that, what do you think you learned at Hellgap that has contributed to like your future academic career?
Honestly, I learned so much there that's contributed to my career right now. Part of it is just working long days. There are times where just because a deadline's coming up or something, I have to put in a 16, 17 hour work day. And I started doing that working for Marcel at Hellgap. I would also say just the basic field skills to work in the U.S. because I took my field school in Scotland, where things are completely different. I was taught to, to dig based on stratigraphy, which when I first started working for Marcel was a disaster because I ended up doing a 15 centimeter level. I just kept looking for the next strata. So.
Oh, no, Mac. That's three levels at Hellgap that you condensed into one that you put into one giant gallon bag. We've lost all context. What have you done, Matt? What have you done?
Filling up buckets. So I really being able to be an archaeologist in the U.S. And then also I did my senior honors thesis at Hellgap on some of the stone circles there. So that really got me on the path of researching stone circles.
Heck yeah, that's
awesome. There are stone circles there. They're at, locality 4?
Oh, they're all over Carlton.
I've just seen the few, man.
You've probably driven over several of them on the way to locality 1.
You know what? You're not wrong.
That's that interesting thing that I've I've actually never been to Hellgap, and also you dug through at least 3 haggis levels yeah while you were doing that but yeah, so like there's this like huge Paleo Indian focus, but there's so much more to be dealt with there, but it's that's what makes the money. That's what keeps that place famous, is that Paleo Indian kind of formation there.
But yeah, there's everything from Paleo Indian to historic components. And I applied for a grant through Wyoming, ended up getting it, and it was able to piggyback off of Marcel's field season, but doing some of my own research out back behind locality 3.
When you're no longer working at locality 1 and you're out on your own on the open prairie looking for stone circles, was the first thing that came to your mind this?
Freedom! It was nice to not. It was nice not being cheek to cheek with people.
There was
talking about Scotland and like the haggis. I was like, I need to download this right now and throw it on the soundboard.
But there was much less like people didn't get like drawn and quartered very often at Hellgap,
no,
did they?
No. After my first year, we had to take down the frame we used for it. We needed some screening, some screening materials.
Oh, that's awesome. How many rattlesnakes did you see at Hellgap?
Dozens.
I spent one summer in Guernsey, and oh my goodness, I had never
They're
seen
everywhere.
A rattlesnake. Yeah. I've never seen a rattlesnake in the field before. And I saw a rattlesnake and then found out that I could levitate.
Yeah, exactly.
What, you weren't a fan of the danger noodles with the tickle sticks?
It was the funny thing is it was so primal that I didn't even register it. I literally like floated away. It was like,
oh, got to your lizard brain.
Yeah, my lizard brain was there.
It's such a creepy sound.
I have an amazing Snapchat, I think, from like my first experience there. I'm wearing my pink fraternity shirt, and I'm just like, there's a rattlesnake behind me hissing, and I'm just like, hey, everybody, meet Steve. Let's get close and see if we can mess with him. And I take like one step, and he like lunged at me, and I was like, all right, never mind, fam. I'm good. Yeah, Steve, I'll check you later, bro. And my mother was not, I like sent that video to my mother. She's like, who are you? I raised you better. Yeah, dude. You know, as Connor and both of you can attest, like, you know, my master's degree was a transformative period away from some of those, my undergraduate behaviors towards a more professional version of what you can say is me now. I think I look back at some of my, I think so. I'm getting there. Doug says I've matured. And then, I'm trying to recall. I don't know why I'm trying to recall because I have your CV right in front of me. I already know the answer. So then from Hellgap, you started at Indiana, right? And pursued your master's PhD, correct?
Yep.
And why did you choose Indiana Bloomington?
I presented some of my research at the Plains Conference and ended up meeting my former advisor there who had also done some research on stone circles back in the day. She seemed pretty impressed by the research, so I decided to apply to IU to work with them.
Understood. And I just remember the first time I met you was at Hellgap. It was, I think, for when the site became a National Historic Landmark. We had a huge party, and we were playing Battle Addle. And that's where I also met Devin for the first time. And Battle Addle, for those that don't know, part of Devin's research in his master's was to basically put foam Nerf balls at the end of Otlatl darts, put on a hockey helmet and baseball umpire pads, and throw Otlatls with these foam tip darts at each other. And that became like a game we played at Hellgap to pass the time. We ended up with bruises. I think like one damn near fractured my ankle because the dart punched through the foam ball. And I just got like the entire force of that dart went straight into my ankle. And Marcel was furious because it was black and blue and I couldn't walk.
I remember challenging you because you had had a fun day and didn't seem too coordinated yet. So I challenged you, and your second or third throw, you just caught me in the throat. I underestimated you.
Yeah.
Oh, crap. I think someone just threw an atlatl at the hemp fields behind my house. We have to end this segment right now. We'll catch you on the other side. Welcome back to episode 31 of the Life in Ruins podcast. David has fallen and cannot get up at this point. We might see him in the third segment, or we might not. He hit his life alert button. We're hoping that he can get up and it'll be fine. We're joined by our guest, Matt Mackenzie Corey, who is a PhD candidate at the University of Indiana Bloomington. So we kind of ended the last segment hinting at what you're doing for your thesis work and possibly dissertation work. So what did you write your thesis on?
So here at IU, we don't have master's theses. We only have dissertations.
Just kidding.
It's nice. We do our qualifying exams are pretty brutal, but for my dissertation, I'm looking at the archaeology of childhood on the Northwest Plains. So I'm kind of approaching this from several different angles. The first of which is something that I've almost gotten done with, just need to crunch a few more numbers. And that is, how do we identify children's play areas in the archaeological record? So really kind of taking the approach of looking at archaeological analysis to develop hypotheses and develop tests to then see what indicators we can look for at archaeological sites. So I'm really interested in stone circles and small stone circles where children would have their play teepees. These can be anything from 6 inches tall. Obviously, you probably aren't going to see any imprint of those in the archaeological record, to up to about 5-6 foot tall, where you could fit a few kids inside. And those largest ones, there's a bunch of historic photographs of them being weighed down by rocks. There's some actually showing where they are in the camp. So I'm looking at really how to identify them spatially. Then I'm taking that, I'm taking some of that knowledge that I've gained and looking at how does this potentially represent childhood agency? I'm specifically looking at Indigenous children here, and I'm going to be looking at the boarding school system. So pretty much, how are children continuing to engage in traditional play in the boarding schools?
So a couple things, and I know I can see some of our friends at Wyoming, like Todd, Chase, Maddie, Mackey, thinking, how do we find childhood in the archaeological record? You know, because, you know, childhood is a abstract concept, right? In terms of, you can't find childhood as an artifact, right? And so you're talking about finding things that we would associate with toys or objects for children and reconstructing their placement at some of these sites. So how, you know, this is just me asking a question, like, how do we know maybe like a play TP 6 inches tall isn't, maybe there was a Plains architect who liked to make little model TPs to show people what he was selling?
That's completely possible. I work very heavily from ethnographies and some recorded oral histories, and children are talking about playing with these miniature teepees. But at the end of the day, there are other reasons that they could exist, and I have to take those into account with my research.
But you're using the ethnographic record of people in the 19th century, anthropologists in the 20th and 19th century, going out, talking with Indigenous people on the plains and noticing children have these items, and they're very similar to what we could find in the archaeological record, right? So it's not totally unfounded. It's very much based on real data and real human behavior.
Yes, and historic photographs. And then I'm currently applying for grants to look at like the South Dakota State Historic Society archives and a few other archives in the region to try and find kind of your non-mainstream histories. Your ones that are separate from, say, Black Elk Speaks, your lives of ordinary people and what they're saying.
Honestly, I wish I had a play TP growing up that I could manipulate and see how they're supposed to be formed. Because, you know, my cousin just bought one before the summer and made, you know, he asked me and Lana to come over and help out. And to help out was like him standing back and watching me and my petite 5'4", 70-pound girlfriend manipulate these like 20 to 30-foot poles and all of these canvas tarps to move his TP from one place to another. And I had no experience on what I was doing. And I was winded by the end of that.
That's how I met a lot of my partner Emily's cousins. Is just she dropped me off with one of her uncles one day, and I had to put up a half dozen teepees with them.
That's metal.
Yeah, that's that's very much thrown to the wolves, or you know,
thrown to the bison, thrown to the buffalo.
Yeah, whatever, you know, whatever they are mostly associated with. So I'm interested to see how people have received your research, kind of in general, because this is a question I think we all have in the back of our heads about archaeology. Like, so, you know, mainly we focus on men as hunters or men as gatherers in the record. So it's nice to see folks who are asking about, like, where are women in the archaeological record, or where are kids in the archaeological record? How has your research been, like, generally received?
At first, poorly, because I had no idea what I was doing. And people rightfully asked, how the fuck are you going to do that?
I don't know why that's so funny. I'm so sorry.
Well, no, it is.
That was my reaction when you told me what your research is about. I was like, what are you talking about? I remember like at Plains in South Dakota when you're in Bismarck and you're just like, yeah, this is what I do. That was like the first time we met outside of Hellgap. We met.
That was the first time we met sober.
Yes. Yes. And you tell me more about your research because I was trying to go to Indiana. I was looking at Indiana for my PhD. And that's also where I met Emily, and we discussed that in her episode back in episode 3. Wow, in episode 3. So yeah, so you, it's an interesting problem, right? Because Children do exist. That's a fundamental truth. You don't have adults without children. Cultures all across the world have concepts of childhood. Now, maybe the experiences differ when people come to adulthood are different, but there is a lived experience of childhood when you don't have the responsibilities of the adult. And there are those concepts and materials that are associated with children. Like, how do you keep children busy? How do you teach them how to be functioning members of society? And that's, you know, you use that through toys and through play. So you are approaching something that is instrumental to a human's life, and you are coming from a new question of like, how do we see this in the archaeological record? So you have the ethnographic record to back you up and to provide you a starting point for what, how can we see these things in the material past?
Yeah. And now that I kind of have my research designed together, I've gotten a lot more positive feedback about it. People are like, oh yeah, this is something we should be looking at. And something that I think you brought up that is really important to understanding childhood is that you kind of talked about this idea of enculturation, teaching children how to be functional members of society. I think that's really neat, but that's not necessarily the focus of my research. Instead of looking at child rearing, which is that process of enculturation, taking care of them, making sure they're fed, I'm curious about childhood itself. How do children view it?
That's super interesting, especially because we don't see how kids grow up in prehistory. It's like, it's not something that we have grasped recently. So I love this idea about like trying to get in touch with that, because we're fundamentally different. You know, I was raised with an Xbox or a PS2 or whatnot. And I think this is really cool research to talk about this, you know, to at least have this conversation and from a good research standpoint.
And I mean, it's challenging, right? It's not like I can go to a deeply stratified site and just work on it for a few summers, write a dissertation about it. I'm having to go to 6 or 7 different places in the nation to look at archives. And I mean, right now, just for kind of that spatial testing that I was talking about, my database is over 2,400 sites that I've had to hand measure a lot of maps on.
Honestly, you have talking about how your research was initially reacted to and how it's kind of perspective from people that have heard about your research that has changed. I resonate with that because that's kind of been a similar experience to how I've looked at your research. I mean, I've always respected you as an academic, but hearing like, you know, early on how you've looked at it and then moving forward towards how your research plan has progressed, it makes a lot more sense, which is like fundamental to like any dissertation, right? You have a question, you don't know what you're doing. Everyone's like, oh, well, you know, how are you going to do that? And by the end, you know, towards the end of the whole thing, you have everything mapped together, right? Has anyone else in the literature kind of attempted to analyze these same experiences that you're looking at?
Yes. So there's another researcher named Michelle Langley who, right before I took my qualifying exams, put out an article about kind of interpreting things as ritual versus interpreting things as childhood, and brought in case studies from around the world, including play teepees. Well, last year I ended up kind of sending her an email thanking her for writing the paper and got invited to present at a conference in Australia with about 18, 19 other scholars who are all looking at childhood in similar ways.
That's cool. I mean, I'm glad there's at least a recognition of that in the record, because it's like I said, I mean, it's at least a third or like a quarter or even a fifth of some people's lives where they live in, you know, in these underage stuff. So I'm glad that there's this consensus of folks who are at least asking the same question. So, and were you really interested in this question because of some of your work in Wyoming and kind of the Western Plains?
Yeah, actually. So it's funny that Carlton brought up Maddie Mackey back at the beginning. So I got a really, really rough NSF review when I first applied for funding, because my old project was just looking at stone circles in general. It was poorly designed. It was kind of terrible, but it was a fair review, but man, it was rough. So I was back in Laramie and getting some coffee at Turtle Rock and ran into Maddie Mackey. So I started talking to her about what she was doing, and she had wrapped up her thesis research on hand sprays, and part of that was looking at children. So we started talking about this, and I started telling her about these strange like stone circles and miniature teepees that I had seen, and she kind of told me like, look into that.
That's dope. Huge shout out to Maddie Mackey. I was just emailing her the other day. I think both Connor and David, whenever David gets back, if he ever gets back up from his life alert. Oh, time. Shut up. You're not supposed to be introduced yet. So Maddie Mackey, huge support, I imagine. Both Connor and David could both attest to it. Like, Maddie was kind of like, when I entered the program, Maddie was like a mom for grad students, elder grad student, one of the elder grad students who helped a lot of us younger grad students figure out what they were doing and knew a lot of connects. And it was honestly because of Maddie Mackey. When I worked at Alm Rock Shelter and I was looking for more employment, she was the one that told me to work at Hellgap. So, you know, huge shout out to Maddie. And also congratulations on the recent SAA publication on Laprelle that came out as a report. So I was really excited to see that. Shut up. Right. You're not supposed to be here yet. we haven't introduced you. Maddie Mackey, great. I'm so happy that she's going to help you. It's like, you know, we have a small field and the people that you know, they all help each other out and everyone you can have support. You know, this podcast is a testament to it in terms of who you can rely on to create great content.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to jump off of that and say that David has hit his life alert button and he is currently standing upwards.
I've fallen and I can't get up.
He has a question for Mac.
Maybe not.
What's do up? It!
Yeah, sorry.
Just do it!
I literally have no idea what we've been... Okay, I do have a question if that was serious. In archaeology... or in the past, if we were to dig up a site, what are the markers that like would show that a child was there? Like structures or tool or something like that? Or
There's several. The ones that I look at are play areas, but there have also been some arguments made for amateurly made and very small projectile points that could possibly be affiliated with, one, children making them, and two, with children's bows. You also have some of the more obvious ones, like if you are lucky enough to go into a dry cave and find something organic like a doll, that's a pretty good indicator. I tend to stay away from research that involves human remains at all. Not my jam, but there is a considerable body of research looking at kind of what children are buried with.
Solid.
Interesting. I mean, especially in North America, it's hard to breach those questions with respect for the indigenous nations that are behind them.
That's cool. I assume there's probably a lot of different ways we could see children in the past. It's just like maybe we haven't, like, kind of like when Aaron was talking about his tattoo implements, like we might have overlooked a couple cactus needles or awls as like tattoo needles. We thought they were, you know, for making hides or something, but like there's probably things like that that are clear indicators of children that we just haven't thought of yet, maybe.
Yeah. And childhood is also highly cultural specific, yeah. Right? If I go 300 miles west from my research area, we're getting into kind of Great Basin childhood. And some of your Great Basin groups kind of interpret childhood differently and will have different archaeological indicators of childhood.
Yeah. Like, pin the tail on the bison.
Walk 500 miles. And I would walk
500 more.
Just to see the kind of
person.
I was going to go with the childhood verse with it, but.
Go ahead.
Just
anyway.
We're clearly not.
However, we have reached the step in our. God. We have reached the mile marker in this segment, and we will be back with segment three with our conversation.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
See you soon.
Welcome back to episode 31 of Life in Ruins podcast. I am here with my co-host, David and Connor Johnen. David has managed to finish up his new product line with Maybelline and answered his life alert. So he will be joining us for this third segment, as you've probably guessed. So Mac, before we begin on our heavy topic of the evening, you know, we've had Emily Van Alst from episode 3. She's been on before and she is your partner. And I wanted to kind of ask you, because, you know, you have a very unique perspective in the field of anthropology, that you are dating an indigenous anthropologist, partnered with an indigenous anthropologist. And I just want to know, like, how has that experience of being with an indigenous person while also studying an indigenous archaeological record, how has that contributed to your methodological and theoretical perspectives? Like, did you notice there was a change in how you approach things? And like, what has that been experience for you fundamentally?
So the biggest change was, for me, theoretically, where indigenous archaeology was, to me, was no longer a lofty goal. It became the normal expectation. Archaeology here in the United States should be for indigenous people. If you are working with Native history, you need to make sure what you're doing is for indigenous people.
And how would you recommend people doing that? How would you recommend people's research be for indigenous people?
It's really tricky, right? Like, it's one thing to consult with Native nations and talk to them about your research, see what they want to be done. But it's also really hard to do that as a graduate student, because you have to have a level of trust, right? And that is actually a challenge that I'm running into with my research. Like, I can talk to Emily, I can talk to her family. And the Hehaka Oyate has been amazing to me. They've been super helpful and they have shared so much with me. But at the same time, they're one family within a much broader region that I work in.
So you're trying to deal with this kind of larger mistrust of anthropologists and archaeologists, and trying to overcome that, which is super difficult. I mean, we don't have a great history with them. So how have you, like, kind of overcome it so far?
With my work, that's one of the reasons why I am, well, one, pretty much anything that comes out of this project, it is going to go back to the nations. Like, my dissertation, every single Native nation that I can identify as having used archival data from an individual from there, or anyone's life history that I've used to create my research, I am going to coordinate with the nations to make sure that they have access to my research. First of all, that is beginning to develop that trust, right? But as I go into my career, it becomes more and more important to really engage with these nations and try and do a good job, right? I mean, it's really hard because I am the whitest of white dudes. Emily makes sure that I stay in line and make sure that I'm doing the right thing.
Dude, Emily keeps me in line too, so you're not alone with that.
Yeah.
You know, I would definitely love to have you come down to the Pawnee Nation Museum in Pawnee, Oklahoma to present. I think that regardless if you use Pawnee ethnography at all, but I think that would just be fun to have you come down and spark some interest in some of our elders. You know, I'm pretty close friends with Emily and Mac at this point, and I've stayed at their house. And, like, you had to learn Lakota as, like, a language requirement, didn't you?
Yep.
And their whole house is, they're like, you know, those little, what are they called? Label makers. Their entire house is covered in, like, Lakota vocabulary words on objects.
Yep. We spent an afternoon going through and putting vocabulary up, because it's important to her and it's important to me. And if we ever have children, they're going to be Lakota children. And I want to make sure that they have access to their family's language.
Dude, that was really impressive. Like, when I walked in and I saw all that stuff, not only did my eyes started bleeding as a Pawnee, but I thought it was amazing and a great effort to do that.
Well, and it's especially important because, you know, there's obviously a lot of indigenous languages that are dying. So just, and it's awesome to see it, like, as simple as, like, a little label here and there that, like, sparks and keeps alive this kind of language. And that's absolutely fantastic. I'm glad you guys are still doing that.
The only thing Emily and I don't disagree on is the orthography. She likes to put hooks underneath her vowels for nasalization. I like to put an N hook after my vowels for nasalization. It's the one thing we disagree on.
Nerds.
For the uneducated, well, the educated audience, the uneducated me, can you define orthology?
Orthography. It's the way you write language.
Right. Okay. Yep. God, I'm just trying to help out the average Joe listening to our podcast.
Is it orthology about birds?
Yeah, orthology is birds. 100%.
Letter and number dyslexia. I don't know what I'm doing.
Once again, the reason why I brought it up was to commend you and kind of really establish that Emily, of course, being a Lakota person, highly recommend you guys listen to episode 3 again, back in our catalog. And moving forward, you know, Mac, I've known you. I think we really haven't really had a strong relationship until we've always talked since Hellgap that we talked about in segment 2. But until you and Emily hooked me up with my current partner. they're the reason why I'm with Lana. In terms of that, we started talking more and really collaborating more. And something that has kind of come out of that new relationship with you and Emily on a more not just professional ground, but personal ground, that you experienced an event in your graduate career fundamentally changed the direction that you were going. And it's definitely not an experience that you've had to take on by yourself, that other people in the field have experienced. And, you know, before this episode, we talked about if it was okay that we mentioned this. So for our listeners, we're not just like, you know, bringing this up to Mac and just like sneak attacking Mac. So would you like to describe this pivotal moment in your career?
Yeah, we're really getting into the rough stuff here. It wasn't just one event. It was really kind of two events that were really terrible. The first was when I first told my former advisor that Emily and I were dating. They were very intoxicated, and they were not pleased about the news, and they went off on me and called me a worthless dime a dozen white man researcher. And it was terrible, right?
Holy shit.
And I stuck around after that. I just viewed it as, okay, they were drunk. I talked to them about it. They apologized. And I'm like, okay, this is going to be fine. Like one-time thing. And then the following summer, and I mean, well, that put me in just like terrible headspace, and really it screwed me up for the next 4 months. Then the following summer, I was working in the field with them, and they decided to drunk drive my students back over 3 hours.
After. Now, was there someone in the vehicle? I mean, A, you should never drive intoxicated, yeah. But was there someone able to in the vehicle that could have driven who was sober?
Yes, and they assured me that that person would be driving back. And that was just, it was a massive betrayal of massive betrayal of trust. And then on top of that, we were doing backcountry work, and it just was not safe. I mean, before I was an archaeologist, I worked at a Boy Scout camp for several years teaching outdoor skills. I've been camping my entire life, and I know how to run a safe camp. I know how to camp safely, even in the backcountry, and none of what this person was doing was safe. That was kind of a breaking point for me, where I realized I cannot continue to work with this person. I cannot continue to work with a person who will endanger my students' lives. I'm not about that. So I reported all of this to the university, and the university took away this person's field school for a few years and gave them a slap on the wrist. But I took this person off of my committee. I have a completely new advisor now who's amazing, and a new committee member who's amazing. But this was a month before quals, so it was kind of a scramble to get through quals. And then there was a good few months where it's like all of the adrenaline that was keeping me going and all of the spite that was keeping me going, just trying to get to that next step, kind of died down. And it took me a few months to kind of get my groove back, to figure out what I was about.
And just to clarify for folks, Is this the advisor that you had came to IU to study with? So it's reporting someone you actually respect and wanted to work underneath.
Yes. And the only kind of like one of the only people in the region who did work in the region at IU. So like my current advisor, she works down in Mexico. So there's a limited number of connections with kind of the Northwest Plains archaeological community, which is why I'm so thankful to a lot of the Wyoming people like y'all for keeping me in the mix, even though I moved away.
Yeah. I mean, I remember for professional reasons, you told me what was going on just due to our professional societies that we're involved in. And I remember you telling me this information and, you know, I talked to my advisor. I didn't address names. And I was like, I couldn't imagine in like 1,000 years, like being in a position that you were. And actually I doubted myself if I had the ability to do what you did and report it. And that's because for our listeners, like, when you go to grad school, you're looking for an Obi-Wan Kenobi. You are looking for a sensei. That is the person who is supposed to guide you through your graduate career and make you a professional. And what you did took an extreme amount of courage and determination. And because of what you did, I have an insurmountable respect for you. Because I personally don't know if I could do that.
To do so put my career at risk. If it was one of those things where it became like this person, I said this, the other person said that, and a bunch of the faculty stuck with this other person, I could have had no committee here and kind of been dead in the water, right? I'm glad it didn't turn out that way, but it was, I mean, I think Emily and I had a 4 or 5 hour conversation where it was just like, how do we address this? And we decided to have me make the official report because I was closer to my qualifying exams. And it's like, I could master out if I had to, and Emily would kind of not get the worst of the blowback then.
Did you have to like meet with like a dean or anything and sign a bunch of stuff? Or?
I met with a provost. I didn't sign anything. Okay. And I refuse to, because it's something that needs to be talked about. And it's like, I was going up against an institution, right? I was going up against something that was a lot more powerful than me. Like the imbalance of power was so great between both my former advisor and the institution, where it's just like, I didn't sign anything. I made my report. I got out of there. And, I've had to answer some follow-up questions since then, but.
And this is like a larger problem in the field and in academia in general with reporting advisors, right? And this is why where sexual assault and some of these other things get pushed under the rug, even historically in anthropology, right? Like how many out of the three of you, and this is a general question, like how many of you know who Dr. Walter Taylor is from the 1940s theory?
I didn't do the readings this week.
Exactly. You know, this and there's a long line of history of when you attack people in power, you don't go anywhere. And for those that don't know, I didn't even learn about Walter Taylor in my theory class at Wyoming. He's like this forgotten dude because he came back from World War II, didn't have a tenured position, and attacked like the 6 greatest archaeologists of the time for their theory who were doing culture theory. And they buried his ass.
Yep.
And you don't hear about him. Like he's forgotten. And so for our listeners who aren't in academia, your advisor is pivotal to your career, and it is a tough choice to see some of the, and like, you know, academics are still people. They still do horrible things. And to be someone from a position of less power, like a graduate student, like Mac in his case, to step up and to do the right thing has consequences that impact you for the rest of your life, potentially, right? As you mentioned, Mac, you said it could have gone one or two ways. Either the rest of the IU, you know, the anthropology department could have sided with your former advisor, or they could have sided with you. And fortunately, they sided with you. But, you know, in the case that they didn't, like you said, you would have mastered out. And then where would you be, right?
Yeah. And one of the biggest impacts that had on me was if I were to run a field school now, if I were to run a field program now, it would be dry. I've become very, very aware of how people can use alcohol to further that imbalance of power. And I think everyone should feel safe in archaeology. Everyone should have a fair shot to feel safe in archaeology. And I've had drinks with all of you, right?
Yeah.
And I'm having a glass of wine.
You having a drink. Yeah.
I'm having a glass of wine right now talking to you. But to me, field work is a professional space. And especially with students, we need to make sure that that starts out as a professional space and not having this idea that it's a party, that it's a free for all, but that it's an inclusive, safe place.
Yeah. To piggyback off that, I don't want to segue too hard, but like, I've been to multiple field schools, dozens, if not like whatever in the 30s number is of different excavations and sites. But like, I have seen alcoholism just like rampant in archaeology, and especially in CRM. Like, it was pretty bad, especially at field schools though. Like, I can just, I mean, I'm trained to be an observer, you know, and like, I've seen kids like feel pretty like pressured to drink because everyone else is like, even like, you know, and it's like, you want to fit in at the same time. And it's like, yeah, I don't know. It just, there's a lot of it. I think in moderation, like, obviously it's like, it's fun if you're like over 21, whatever, but like, just as a culture, like, I think there's too much of it. Maybe, I don't know. It's a hard topic.
There is. It is. And I mean, I can tell you for sure, especially when I was dealing with some of the stuff with the former advisor, I definitely drank too much. It was a coping mechanism, and it's one that I recognize as being a problem, and it's one that I take care to avoid now.
Yeah. I've never blacked out in my life, except for the night, I shouldn't ever put this on a podcast, but when I defended my thesis, like, I felt like that was one night I could just like, you know, do whatever, but
that,
like,
was a fun night.
I wish I knew about it, but like,
I remember, yeah, parts, see,
that's
of it,
the that's the thing. Like, that's not good. Like, I had a great day during the day, but like, that, I just woke up in my bed and like, apparently my shoes were, someone, I mean, nicely took my shoes off and stuff and put me in my bed. But I was like, I was at the bar a minute ago, and I've never done that before. And it was like in an archaeological setting, and I was like, damn, that's not good.
No.
But
yeah, I want to state first, thank you, Mac, for coming on and telling your story, especially in this last segment. We super appreciate you taking your time and putting your neck out to make these situations right. So I want to applaud you for doing that. And because this is a Life in Ruins podcast, we have to ask the question. Mac, if given the chance again, would you still choose to live a life in ruins?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's been ups, there's been downs, but I love what I do, and I want to keep doing it the rest of my life.
Great answer.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much, Mac, for coming on. We just interviewed Mackenzie Corey, who's a PhD candidate at the University of Indiana, studying, you know, how can we see childhood in the archaeological record. Mac, do you have any social media that you'd like to plug?
Yep, I'm just at Mackenzie Corey on Twitter. So pretty easy there.
Sweet. And for our listeners, his Instagram, Twitter, and other social media is in the podcast description.
I have one last question to end it on. If you could answer in like a sentence, what is the most important thing people should know about like children in prehistory and children in archaeology?
Children have agency. Children can make their own decisions. And that is one of the coolest things that we are just not talking about.
Awesome. I was hoping you would say that, because I remember you telling me that at the bar, actually, and I was like, that's a very good point.
All right. And everyone, that was episode 31 of A Life in Ruins. And with that, we are out.
Thanks for listening to A Life in Ruins podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at A Life in Ruins podcast. And you can also email us at alifeinruinspodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, make sure to bring your archaeologists in from the cold and feed them beer. This is Connor at the end of episode 31. Usually at this point, I would tell you like an extreme dad joke, but I want to take this time to devote to, you know, I want people to be able to express themselves in colleges and anything like that. And please report any sort of abuse that you've been going through. You know, we are here for you and we want to support you and we want to make this field better. So thank you for your time.
Awesome.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Culturo Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.